Welcome to episode 290 of Five and Dive. It is Thursday, June 1st. I'm your host, the prospect writer at Baseball Prospectus, Jeffrey Paternostro. Joining me for our regular Thursday show. We didn't do a Monday show. It was a holiday and nothing really happened over the weekend. Then a lot of stuff has happened since then. I guess the Chase Anderson start did happen over the weekend, but don't worry, we'll catch you up on that. And to do that, I am joined by writer and editor at Baseball Prospectus, Patrick Dubuque, and associate editor, Jenny Searle. How are we all doing?
I'm doing okay. The holiday has wiped me out. I'm still catching up, but...
Yeah, I mean, I spent my Monday morning watching my soccer team score 123rd minute winner in the League One playoffs, and that one, I was pretty much done for the day. I had to take the kid to the aquarium after that and just, like, let her run around and look at sharks, so I did not have to use any part of my mental or physical faculties. I didn't even drink, but I was just completely and utterly exhausted after watching that game. But it is not soccer season anymore. I guess there's still the FA Cup and the Champions League final. It is baseball season. This is a baseball podcast, but primarily this is a Chase Anderson podcast. So our first topic, Chase Anderson facts. Patrick.
Okay, well, we're going light this time. Chase Anderson. So I declared on Twitter, this is the policy of the podcast. We will continue doing Chase Anderson facts until either Craig gets back and bars them, or until Chase Anderson loses or retires. In order, you know, to diversify so that we're not all stuck in the Chase Anderson basket, we need to branch out, and therefore we need to approach the possibility of Julio Teheran facts. Julio Teheran back in baseball after spending the 2022 season in the independent leagues. He was picked up by the Brewers because they had no starters. And so now we have two Chase Andersons. We have the real Chase Anderson and we have backup Chase Anderson. And both of them pitched quite well last week. Anderson went five innings, gave up five base runners and a single earned run with four strikeouts. And Teheran had a real interesting line where he pitched six innings, gave up four hits, no walks, no strikeouts, and no walks, and no earned runs.
Yeah, I will say I was editing the doc and I was like, it's mucking about with Google Docs on my phone. And I thought I had accidentally deleted how many Teheran strikeouts he had. But no, it was just another, zero. Yeah.
I watched the post game interview from Craig Counsell on Teheran. And first of all, he is leaning back about 25 to 30 degrees in his chair after a win. Like, he looks just exhausted, just drained of all energy. And he first off says, yeah, he didn't have all his pitches. And his compliment, and I like this compliment because it sounds like one, is he's a veteran. He has a good idea of swings, which, you know, I guess if you're a pitcher.
He's seen a lot of swings.
He's seen more swings, I feel like, than maybe he should, given that he had exactly two whiffs on the day.
How long till you get a great idea of swings? How many pitches does that take to see?
You know, I think you have to get, you know, like, seriously drilled by a comebacker, and then you have a great idea of swings. Anderson, so our current status, like, I checked on Anderson's preseason Pecota projections from March 30th, and Pecota's 50th percentile projection for Chase Anderson was a 4.89 ERA. And a 121 DRA minus. Now, we have percentiles for our projections. And so I checked Chase Anderson's best case scenario, his 99th percentile. And in that case, he had a 4.43 ERA.
The narrow range of possibilities.
Here. He had a 1 in 100 chance of being an average pitcher. He currently has a 1.31 ERA. So he's doing fine. Teheran, interestingly enough, a very similar 50th percentile, 4.58. ERA and a 118 DRA minus, but the best possible Teheran is actually pretty good, 3.24 ERA and a 92 DRA minus. I guess because Pecota can get nostalgic with the best of them and look back on those 2013 through 2016 seasons and think, yeah, there was a guy.
I'll tell you could tell me Julio Teheran was basically any age at this point and I'd believe you, but I feel like he's still somehow early 30s.
Yeah, he's 32. Like, he's
yeah, so
younger.
It's still, yeah, end of his peak, whatever that means.
His fastball is not 32. No. He touched 91 yesterday. He is averaging 90. Any gains he had made in 2021 after the pandemic season are gone. It doesn't, if you ask me which of them was going to be better going forward, having watched them both, I think Chase Anderson actually has, like, Anderson can get to 94, 95.
Still. He struck someone out.
He has literally struck somebody out. His pitches, like, Anderson, he does not have command anymore. A lot of his pitches were sailing against the Mets. They were flying out of the zone, like not getting.
Yeah,
not...
I watched the game. Like, he does feel, this is a weird comp, but it's one that I think of. He kind of feels like Philadelphia Phillies Pedro Martinez at this point. Not as good as Philadelphia, but it's like the Philadelphia Phillies Pedro Martinez version of Chase Anderson.
It feels like Chase Anderson is stealing 10 minutes away from the end of his life to throw each pitch. Like he's borrowing future life force and just hucking it. It's like he's erasing a whiteboard marker with his bare thumb and just, you know, taking that time off the end. Whereas Julio Teheran, just, you know, it doesn't look like he has anything left. It looks like he's just
like the Perry Bible Fellowship comment, yeah. Like happy birthday, and the guy jumps up and you just see death like putting the thing down in the abacus. Like every time Chase Anderson gets a swing and miss, there's just like one one more thing put on the abacus.
So yeah, so we'll see. I actually am curious as to which one lasts longer. I think it's gonna be Chase Anderson. I feel
like we're gonna be chronicling this for a while.
Yeah, we might.
Julio Teheran had a 1.0 Julio Teheran had a 1.755 within 2020. It's just good to know, I think.
I have a no good if I like I knew he was in indie ball last year. It's something I knew at the time. It is not something that I put into any sort of short, medium, or long-term recollection. But I'm wondering, okay, like he was actually legitimately good in the Atlantic League.
Yeah, he was.
But like, okay, I can see that guy.
So I feel like Julio Teheran is going to be my new Daniel Cabrera, as the guy you jokingly bring up 5 years after he's retired to be like, you know, this guy's still only 37. Daniel Cabrera last pitched in 2009. He is 42 years old. So he no longer works, but for a long time, you could make Daniel Cabrera jokes.
Is he older or younger than Edwin Jackson?
I think he is a little older. Not much. He's younger than Rich Hill.
Well, yes. That is for sure. Aren't we all?
Edwin Jackson, 39.
Edwin Jackson, Jesus. I think I guess at least like early 40s. But anyway, our second topic. The Revolution will not be televised. Bally Sports has missed payment to MLB, and MLB has allowed the rights to revert to their control. The league will continue selling games to cable, but if you have MLB TV and you live in San Diego and you want to watch the Padres without blackout restrictions, it'll only cost you another $20 per month. And the team itself is guaranteed, at least through the league, whether they fought back with cable sales or, I assume, in market MLB TV sales, at least 80% of whatever their contracted revenue was under this RSN agreement for the rest of the season. And I don't know what MLB is going to do after that. And obviously, this is only the first of many teams that are going to be put in that situation. We can talk about in a moment if this might be the blueprint for what they're going to do. I do want to point out the Padres are actually one of the better watched in market teams. At least they were in 2022, which I suppose makes sense. They were quite good. They had a lot of good, fun players, good TV product. And they had a 5.1 rating, which means 5% of their in-market cable subscribers were watching Padres games on average. I don't know what the Bally Sports carriage fee was. I'm guessing, we do a little math, and I guess it was around $1. Probably maybe even a little bit more. But obviously, if 5% of your audience is watching it, and the other 95% is paying for that station, regardless, when that other 95% stops paying for that station, you got to make up the money somewhere. And 20 times whatever your carriage fee was, it seems like the kind of math MLB would do, Patrick.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is very Vegas stadium money math. Yeah, I think that is probably the most interesting aspect of all of this, is the idea that baseball will have to start charging people directly for baseball.
Yes.
As opposed to charging non-baseball fans for baseball. And it's interesting that the Padres are going first because the Padres are good and they're fun and they're watchable. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious as to what's going to happen when we get the first non-fun, non-watchable team. Like, remember those early teens Astros that were pulling the 0.1 rating?
And we're just talking about the A's here. So we're talking about
them. Yeah, like those 0.1 Comcast ratings for those tanking Astros teams. And you wonder, like, is this going to like make tanking actually difficult for the first time in a generation?
So I do have the at least the top RSNs. They're very cagey about who the bottom ones are, looking at this story for obvious reasons, I would assume. But the top five last year were the Cardinals, Padres, Brewers, Phillies, and Astros. But I suppose all makes sense, right? Mostly primarily baseball markets in almost all the cases there. I guess well, St. Louis and San Diego used to have football teams, but you know, probably the primary team in all of those markets, I guess Packers and whatnot. And I don't know. I don't listen to WIP as a rule, so I can't tell at any given time what Philadelphia sports fans are on about. I would prefer just not to know. And some of this is going to be too, you know, less competition from other sports, right? You have, these are all one baseball team towns as opposed to, you know, New York or LA. And they do note that there are 12 shared markets where baseball is the highest rated. And that is Atlanta, Cleveland, Denver, Detroit, Houston, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, New York, Philadelphia, Seattle, St. Louis, and Tampa Bay. Boston, interestingly enough, hockey town.
Hmm.
The Bruins are the most watched, I assume, by market share. But yeah, what is this going to look like for the other 17 teams or whatever it is?
Yeah, the one thing to mention is that MLB is providing 80% or paying 80% of what the RSN would have been paying the Padres, and has said that it'll do so for any of the teams that potentially get dumped by Diamond, which is good to know. But I mean, that's, I think in the Padres, it's like 40 cases, it's like $48 million or something. It's a lot of money to make up from those subscribers for a team like the Padres, but at least they've got, you know, like we're talking about, the big fan base. I don't necessarily see, like, yeah, the bad teams having really how many people are going to be paying twice as much as they pay Netflix or whatever to see some team that's going to win 50 games.
I assume this is kind of a short-term solve, obviously. If you know it's just for the rest of the season and you have no other option, really, you might just be like, okay, they're going to have to figure out some sort of bundling. I mean, maybe it'll just be an existent MLB TV product and they'll bump it to, I don't even know what I paid this year. I think around 150 or so.
I think it's 140 without the discounts, yeah.
Yeah, so if you bump it to like 200 and you get in market streaming. But again, we've talked about the RSN bubble now for, I mean, really since the Dodgers went through everything with McCourts, because I think they were the first one to get a $1 billion cable deal. And then obviously there's the issues with Houston shortly after that, not being available in their markets. And obviously you've had teams start up their own cable networks in partnership or otherwise, you know, SNY and YES at this point are 15, 20 years old. You know, the Cubs one is more recent, and other teams have looked at that as well as an additional revenue stream. And now it's, you know, is this the first domino to fall? What does watching Major League Baseball on TV or devices or your computer or whatever look like 5 years from now?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that we're talking about something that's kind of, it's easy to be both optimistic and pessimistic. And I think that's why, you know, we're seeing such dramatic opinions on both sides.
It'll be great for the fans right up until the next CBA.
Right. It'll be great for the fans until they have to pay extra, and then it'll still be great for the fans, but also it won't be great for the fans. We're going to end up paying more for baseball at the end of this, because you have to. Like, there is a bunch of people who didn't want baseball who are paying for it, and now they won't. And one of the things that I think we've seen in the greater picture in the last, you know, couple of years since the pandemic, businesses aren't good at the idea of having to adjust to lower revenue. And so, you know, baseball is going to miss that money. You know, they can do this, they can create this package. And I think the package itself is fine, right? They are trying to create a product that they can sell. There's nothing wrong with that. It sucks that we have to take Rob Manfred's side on this as far as, you know, the dealings with Bally. Like, Bally's just, it's not, they say they missed payment. They're just not paying. They signed a contract and they don't want to pay it because they made a bad deal and then they realized how bad their deal was. But baseball is going to lose money from this in the long run. And they're going to try to, you know, offload as much of those losses as they can, just like Bally is trying to offload all of its losses. And we're going to pay for it, mm-hmm. ultimately.
Yeah.
And the question is, how good a product can they make to justify how much of the cost they're going to offload?
Yeah, one thing I wrote about this today, if anyone wants to read about it. And one thing I just didn't mention is it is very funny that the RSNs are currently in court having the team or the league contest that they should in fact pay the contracts that they agreed to pay. And it's just kind of funny seeing teams beyond the end of that where they are trying to get contracts that they don't want to pay instead of complaining about contracts that they don't want to pay.
Yeah, I don't know what this is going to look like in 5 years because we're also in the middle of a much bigger discussion about the future of TV, just in terms of TV at the moment with the writer's strike. My opinion is that the future of TV and the future of baseball is probably piracy.
I mean, the past and the present in a lot of cases too.
Yes, yeah, well. Not that I would ever condone such a thing.
It's like, I don't know if people, you can Google something like, I don't know, NordVPN or something like that.
Right. Yeah, something like that. Sounds, you know.
I mean, I went to high school in the Napster era, so you know, it's like I'm an old millennial now. This is not news.
But this is essentially like, you know, we deal with sports and have a fan pushback to team behavior, right? And how there's very little that fans can do about bad teams. There is one thing they can do about bad television.
Turn it off.
Yeah. Especially when there's when you have like streaming networks that are removing their own content because they don't feel like paying the royalties and just removing, they're basically making their products worse.
I'm sure MLB would just love to remove A's games from the.
There's always more Yellowstone for people to watch.
Yeah,
but this has been the last 10 years of I mean everything really. The live sports was immune to this for the longest time. They were the driver of what was left of cable television. Like I don't know what USA Network is showing nowadays. No idea. Yeah.
Silk stockings.
Yeah. Lifetime. Is it still Spike TV? I don't know if it's still Spike TV. I just remember when it was TNN, so old I am. But yeah, I don't like, again, direct to consumer a la carte television was supposed to be this great thing. And what we eventually found out is that you can't actually make money on it. So you got a bunch of bundles, and then it just ended up costing as much as the cable TV subscription.
Right. Yeah, and this is kind of our generation. This current time is austerity time. Now, it's austerity time for government. It's austerity time for television and for culture. Is that because those businesses are not used to actually like having losses or even as they treat a reduction of revenue, we're getting worse things for the same money that we were getting before. And the question is, how do we push back on that? And the answer
is, how can
is,
you talk about cultural austerity when we now know what's outside the frame of the Mona Lisa?
And that was so cheap to make.
But that was the thing. Like we've already seen this, right? With like endless Seinfeld or whatever on Twitch. I think it was on Twitch. So like you can just AI generated baseball content. Could you imagine every pitcher having six fingers? Like
Tony Hoffenseca. Yeah. I mean, it'll be on the show, right? They'll just use the show
I mean, we joke that this might cause the economic collapse of the sport
and kind of the death of culture in general.
There's some real
bad outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, MLB is currently in court arguing that the RSNs are lying about not being able to make profits on all this stuff. And they are putting their money basically where their mouth is, I guess 80% of where their mouth is, on that front. And, you know, they're, I was in, I think it was Forbes that was mentioning this, that the big problem that RSNs are having is that, I think it said that it was facing, they were facing extreme profit compression was maybe the right that they used, something like that.
So they're not making as much
which is funny. Right, because in addition to the fact that they get paid on a per subscriber basis and the amount of subscribers that were covered by Diamond in all the markets, where it went from, I think, 61 million in 2019 to 47 at the end of 2021. So, you know, a quarter down. And I mean, I think that outpaced how cable's done in general, but it's still a good amount of people. And there's a couple different revenue streams MLB's getting with the over-the-air broadcast, the ad revenue from there, and the OTC stuff, but whether it actually gets to the same place and whether it gets to a place, whether it gets to the same place and it's still not attempted to be, have to be screwing the baseball or the labor out of it is another question. So I think it's scary. I do think, I don't know.
You might just come to a situation where it's like the Yankees 2 weeks ago, where you just, if you want to watch, I think probably more public or more popular teams, you have to have four different streaming services, because all MLB had already started, you know, piecemealing off, you know, the Peacock games, the Apple TV right. games, and you know, New York, the Yankees run Amazon for a bit. So I mean, there are plenty. Everyone's just moved on to the OTT streaming bubble, which I think is probably going to compress quicker than the RSN bubble, because that's how late stage capitalism usually works. But I do at least enjoy in all of this that the league office does not possess anything resembling a finally honed sense of irony, so they can go into court and argue that another business is lying about how much money they're making.
Yeah. Right.
Look, all we know is that the guys on Wall Street are using $5 bills to light their cigars instead of hundreds. You know, times are tough. It's the only way you can tell.
Our third topic, Pride Month. It is Pride Month. I will say normally this goes by with the usual Major League Baseball Pride nights. There's probably some annoying blue checks in the replies for these. I guess not last year. They may have still been last year too. Probably more so this year. They were blue checks in spirit then. They're blue checks in actuality now. But we started to see this with hockey this spring. Now we have seen several baseball players. Obviously, there's the Pride Night controversy in Los Angeles. Bill Donahoe got his fax machine to work and was able to send off one sternly worded letter to the Dodgers about inviting the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to their Pride Night. Marco Rubio briefly got involved, because why not? And then they uninvited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. There was fan outcry over this, and they reinvited the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. But this seems to have, whether it's hockey or this or the Dodgers blinking, players have started to come out now and actually criticize is not, I mean, they are criticizing Pride Night, but they are doing it in such a way, Anthony Bass less so than others, that they want to have plausible deniability, I guess. And it's been a week of this. Anthony Bass gave a statement, did not take questions, and then essentially got booed for his entire appearance in Toronto. Clayton Kershaw, after his comments, did not respond to comments from The Athletic, questions from The Athletic this morning, digging into Dodgers Pride Night and the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence more. And is this, you know, I suppose on some level, this was always rainbow capitalism. And I don't know where baseball goes from here, I guess. I have a suspicion and I don't like it, but.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, can we just say, why won't anyone stand up for the poor in the midst of its latest sexual abuse scandal, Catholic Church? Why is that not, why are more people not getting on the line for the Catholic Church? And the thing that, who cares, is the thing that it all boils down to. This is, I mean, it's one game that a bunch of people, most of the people who are going to go to the game aren't going for a pride reason. They're just going to go to watch a game. And if there's anything, they'll be like, I wonder what's going on there. And it's just not something anyone cares about. This is Los Angeles, for one thing. It's just ridiculous. And there's nothing interesting or thoughtful to say about it, because it's just all stupid all the way down. And that's everything today, everything these days. But
the team will sell more hats. Like, there will be some hats sales, so that's great.
Uh-huh. Vertical pride stripe hats.
Yeah. So my feeling about this is that how baseball is going to treat this is basically going to be how everybody treats this. And I think it's just we're going to see a major sea change, I think, in general. I was particularly drawn to a section of Trevor Williams, his post about it. And Williams was one had one of the stronger reactions, one of the less equivocating. But one of his lines that he puts later on in his message is the paragraph, "I also encourage my fellow Catholics to reconsider their support of an organization that allows this type of mockery of its fans to occur." And I think that is driving a large part of this, is that this happened to come at the same time that we're having a major social phenomenon about boycott culture, especially on the right, where, you know, we've had Bud Light and we've had, you know, even Chick-fil-A, that noted force of liberal idealism is being criticized by people on the right for having a director of, I think, what was it, director of equality? It's a position that...
It's diversity and equality initiative, DEI, yeah.
Yeah. And what's going on here is that there's been a lot of demands for boycotts that are absolutely not going to happen and never meant to happen, because it doesn't, they don't need boycotts. The boycotts don't actually need to exist. All you need to do is say it, right? All you have to do is just say boycott. And that's enough. Like, you either scare them into doing something, as they got the Dodgers to blink, or you don't. And everybody still eats Chick-fil-A. Who eats Chick-fil-A in the first place? And there's no, it's all in bad faith. And it's all just words for the sake of words. And we're either just going to ride this out, and or else, you know, the words are going to be powerful enough to make some sort of change where corporations do start capitulating to all these things. But, like, I just don't see that happening, because, you know, why are the Dodgers doing a Pride Night? They're doing the Pride Night to sell the hats, right? Like, the Dodgers know that being inclusive is good for business. And so, you know, they're going to keep doing it as long as they think it's profitable. And I don't think this is going to make it not profitable. I don't think that all of this hand-wringing is going to really change much.
Yeah, I saw that there was a couple of credulous outlets were reporting on that that boycott Target song and how it got to be the top of the iTunes sold list for, I don't know, a day or whatever. And then someone else was like saying, oh, well, this song has 50,000 total streams in its existence on Spotify. Like, it turns out, because none of this, like, everything is so, all the, you know, it's the same problem that MLB has with the RSNs. There's so much media, everything is so diluted now that some guy can buy up 1,000 of his own songs on iTunes, get some headlines about how it's the number one song on iTunes for a day, even though no one is actually listening to it. And then suddenly it's more fodder to say, well, look, the boycotts are working, even though they're not actually doing anything. And it's in fact only giving these companies more and more press. And it's just all, it's very boring. I don't know.
And every blue check mark that's responding to these tweets is definitely in support of it. It must be everybody, because that's all you see when you look right underneath.
I will also say, as a longtime podcast producer, host, et cetera, I don't actually count on Apple or iTunes to be able to measure anything properly based on how often they change the algorithm for podcast downloads and listens.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So what I think the thing that I struggle with here is, like, the I don't know how the players don't understand the deal here for the teams. Like, I don't know, you know, we talked about on this podcast, a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, time has no meaning, but we talked about the alignment of the Atlanta Braves values and the values of Quikrete. The bond of those two companies so strong that the Atlanta Braves are willing to slap a yellow sticker of a bag of concrete on their shirts because they feel so strongly about how the values of Quikrete align, or they're just paying them a bunch of money, right? Like, how do the players not realize that this is just about money, and it's all about money, and it doesn't really matter how you feel, because the corporations are just going to do what makes them money? Like, it feels it feels like you can't be that credulous about this. And it's a little offensive to me that we think that this talk, like when we do this cycle of talk, like why were we believing it this time? Why does this time matter? It's just the same. We've had this talk before.
I mean, I guess the Dodgers just basically miscalculated how much blowback they would get for it. Like, because the other part of this is, it seems, whether it's, and this is not even just true of Pride, I'm sure it's true of Irish Heritage Night or whatever else. There's like 20 of these a year. They just figured they're like, well, we're already doing the bare minimum. What more do you want? Like, that's the thing. They do not want to put in a lot of effort for this. Because it's, again, it's not actually about diversity inclusion. It's about saying you have a director of diversity and equality initiatives.
Well, yeah. And the other thing is just, it's just all very stupid in general, but the Dodgers are right. They end up coming in out and reversing course and re-inviting the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence to their thing, which is fine. But, and obviously I'm sure they would have preferred the entire media circus had they been able to, but I think it just illustrates, and mentioning quickly reinforces, not pun intended there, that these are not like, when MLB does a deal with Quikrete, they're not, no player is going to be ripping that patch off of their jersey, because then MLB is in violation of its contract with Quikrete. The whole idea with stuff like the Pride merch is that it's directly to the consumer. There's not like a business that is going to have its values violated by, in theory, at least, by MLB supplying these hats. And I mean, MLB doesn't
I guess technically New Era is supplying these hats, but within their contract with MLB, but MLB, whatever. It's,
sure. Yeah.
But it's like a,
but I mean, instead of,
it's whatever, it's the same general hat contract they have with New Era that also gets you like the weird ones, which have like giant holes in them.
The craters.
Yeah.
Right. But instead of getting money from Quikrete for having a patch on the jersey, MLB is getting money from fans for, in theory, giving this show of support.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Dodgers are, whichever team is doing this. But these teams are not actually willing to give that show of support and stand behind it because they don't have a contractual obligation to. And in fact, it's not going to really lose them money to be capricious and just kind of go with the flow and see whichever side yells louder about it. They have no reason not to, but I think I said when I wrote about this last year that it would be much better if teams just kind of stayed out of this stuff rather than being little cowards in ways that they wouldn't allow with most of their other business practices. But I think that's basically where we are with most businesses right now. So can't say that they're unique.
With that, we'll take a break, come back, go around the horn, and Patrick has some sort of game I'm probably not going to enjoy. Welcome back to episode 290 of Five and Dive. We'll go around the horn. We've been a little hard on the A's in the first half of the show.
Have we?
But now we've been critical of the A's. Maybe not a little hard, but we've been critical of the A's, as you do. They did take 2 of 3 from Atlanta. So I think it's on the back of losing 11 straight after already being on a historically bad pace. So I will frame it this way. Are we, I don't want to say rooting, but is it more interesting? Maybe we're rooting for it. If the A's are historically bad.
I will say Mark Norman wrote about this and I edited that. And he had gone to bed by the time the A's won that second consecutive game. And so I had to edit all the references to their winning percentage in the 190s to be that now they're over 200. So things are, you know, looking up.
You just feel like this happens for maybe not for 50 game stretches like this, but you just feel like they've got a 6 out of 10 in there somewhere that'll get them like out of the 62 Mets range. But I guess also, do they?
Yeah, and Stephen Goldman actually wrote about this on the site today. Yeah, they will. Like they will regress. Yeah. They will not have another 12-46 stretch of 48 games, right?
Right, but they're also, you know, when you're on like a 30, 3-win pace. If you play like a 50-win team the rest of the way, you might not
right
get much over 40. So
I am absolutely rooting for them to lose every single game the rest of the season. Like, yes. I don't want them to win. Yeah.
I figured that would be your answer, Patrick, but I figured I'd at least ask.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I appreciate it. No, they can lose them all, as far as I'm concerned. They are, you know, you want hubris to be punished. Mm. And this is double hubris. It is,
but it's
thinking
and moving, yeah.
And bailing. Yeah. And honestly, like, as you know, as somebody who went through this with the Sonics, like, I don't have a memory of the last season of the Sonics playing in Seattle. I don't actually remember Kevin Durant in a Sonics jersey, which he had technically wore for 82 games. And I don't need to. Like, you don't need to have that memory of the thing dying. You don't have to lock that in your brain as the thing you want to take away from the thing you love. So, you know, I won't tell Athletics fans how to fan, but they can absolutely just walk away now.
A lot of them are, clearly.
Yeah. And just mourn it on your own time, in your own place, in your own bar, in a completely separate way, and just watch them burn. Because, you know, at the very least, John Fisher will have a worse day, right? And that's all you can really ask for.
Yeah, the whole thing with when stuff ends, right? And, you know, when a team leaves, it's like trying to be an A's fan or being a fan of the new team is like walking around your old high school, something like that. And I have to imagine that's just what it's like now, right? Like it's as if there was a divine punishment inflicted upon the A's for the transgression of their owner, but it's actually just that the owner doesn't care and is fine with that being what's inflicted on the fans. It's just, I mean, MLB should have taken ownership or should have taken control of the A's a long time ago, but they don't care to.
Right. I do think that like a 130 loss season or even approaching it does make the move a little tougher, right? It builds resistance in Vegas from constituents. Well,
the other thing we found out today or yesterday, I think, stadium's not going to be open until 2028 now.
Yeah.
So it's... I think that there's two things that are a little bit different. We haven't had a baseball team move in a long time at this point. And there's a lot more. You heard about the Vegas Raiders and the Los Angeles situation in St. Louis and San Diego for a number of years, right? But there was like one final season where everyone knew they were moving, and that was it. I mean, the A's are at least going to play in Oakland next year.
Right.
And then it's very unclear. Like, it's such a bizarre situation. Like, the Las Vegas A's, as we will at one point know them, are still 5 years away. So can they get worse? I mean, they probably can't, but
it's hard to imagine any incentive for them to get better.
Yeah. Next year, right? I mean, at a certain point, are they gonna be playing in the minor league stadium in Vegas? I assume that's what's gonna end up happening. Oakland obviously has no impetus to extend the lease, and MLB leaning on them is probably not gonna go very far in that direction. Yeah, I don't.
I mean, they should go to Buffalo.
I do feel bad for the, like, on some level, you're rooting for a group of players to be very bad at their chosen vocation, which I find a little bit gauche on some level. But also, you know, they're getting, like, there's probably guys on that team that are getting to play Major League Baseball that might not have in this this long a format, at least, right? Like, you know, someone like Ryan Noda, right? He can. He's gotten long, Ron, and other teams are going to look at that and have that data and have those scouting reports. And maybe Ryan Noda will have a 5-year career instead of just kicking around the Dodgers minor leagues. So
I guess they can play fine. They can play fine. I just want the other teams to play better.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. One of the things that's most frustrating to me about this is, like, other owners could have stepped in and kind of stopped all of this from screeching to a halt in so brutal of a fashion. And I think really the only explanation for why they didn't is that enough owners think, well, I want to make sure that if I choose to do something like this in the future, I don't have anyone standing in my way. And some owners aren't, the thing is that some owners aren't going to do this. Like, there are some who definitely would. Baltimore seems to kind of have at least it in the back of their mind. But there's a lot that wouldn't, and it's just so against their interests to allow all of this to happen that I really don't understand. Like, I don't know, I guess they need 8 owners to block stuff, but I guess probably there are 8 owners who would be considering doing this, but it's bleak.
They just think that the it's like just like the line just keeps going up, right, on franchise valuations. So even if this is a minor blip, I mean, is it even really a minor blip, right? David Forrest is going to sell for far more money than you know, in 2030, yeah. when the stadium's up and things are going well, than he would have right now if the league forced him to sell. And all the other owners see that too, right? You know, you mentioned Baltimore, who's, you know, always has a little look over there towards Nashville every once in a while. But we're also going to see a new round of stadiums, I'm sure. We've already seen it in Atlanta and Dallas. We're probably going to see it in Arizona shortly. And the teams need the stick. And if the league steps in and says, there's certain thresholds you have to get over to really threaten and go through with a move, that's just lessens the threat and their ability to extort money from their current locations or a better stadium somewhere else.
Which is another reason why I think expansion won't happen anytime soon.
I was just saying, you mentioned that the graph keeps going up, but you know, the graph kept going up for the RSNs for years and years. So they kind of figured, oh, well, we don't need to figure out streaming. The graph keeps going up, and you'd think that it could be a wake-up call, but I don't think that these are necessarily the type of people who receive wake-up calls.
They assume the market will take care of them, and they are more often than not very right about that.
And when they aren't, they just don't pay their bills.
Yes. We have some injuries to go over. The Frisky, are we calling them Frisky? The Frisky Tigers? They're like one game out of a playoff spot. No, still not Frisky. They're just in the AL Central. They are in the AL Central. Yeah. The Tigers are in the AL Central and it came out of a playoff spot. They'll be without their best starter for a bit as Eduardo Rodriguez is headed to the injuries list with a finger injury, joining, I think at this point, they have probably 4/5 of their projected opening day rotation on the IL. I don't remember exactly when Casey Mize went down, so I don't know if that's true, but certainly Matt Manning and Tariq Skubal in there as well. But yeah, they're still in the AL Central, so hope springs eternal. They're calling up Reese Olson, who's a decent enough pitching prospect, not as good as Eduardo Rodriguez, but should at least be able to give them serviceable major league innings, which they're in the AL Central. So AL East a little bit trickier, and the Orioles will be without Cedric Mullins for a little bit. He is in the midst of a groin strain. Patrick, they have signed Aaron Hicks to a major league deal. He is 2 for 2.
Hey, he had to go somewhere.
He did. And their top two outfield prospects, Colton Cowser and Hudson Haskin, who are both very good in AAA this year, are injured. So, yeah, Aaron Hicks.
You want a guy who won't block anyone too hard, right?
You say that, but also Adam Frazier is currently.
That's true.
Like, they'll find somebody to block you, even if they have to go out and sign Adam Frazier. Not specifically injured, but the weak link in the Dodgers rotation. Noah Syndergaard got knocked around by the Nationals yesterday, and then I will actually defer to Patrick on this, who is the expert on such things. Is this the saddest quote ever given by a Major League Baseball player?
It's pretty sad. Yeah. What was it? I would give my hypothetical firstborn to be the old me.
At least
again.
He doesn't actually have a kid.
Yeah, that's true.
It's going to be worse, I guess.
I mean, you know, my child actually this morning, after not eating their waffles, asked me if they'd be happier, if I'd be happier if they weren't born, which I was going to say an overreaction to how I was responding to their not eating their waffles. I mean, I was annoyed. It was not that big a deal, but like, you know, is my kid Noah Syndergaard? I don't know. I'd do anything possible to get back to that. And this is, I think, for Syndergaard, like the rough part. Like, by all accounts, the man has worked very hard, right? Mm-hmm. He is doing everything he can. He signed with the Dodgers because, like, he took less money because he felt like it was a better shot for him to be a good pitcher. And clearly, being good is what is important to him. The thing, though, if we return to the just saying things, you know, philosophy, there's a Will Smith quote at the bottom of the story in ESPN about Syndergaard. I know Noah specifically is going to keep working his behind off, behind in quotes, Smith said, according to MLB.com. That's what he does. No doubt he'll come back at some point, whether it's this his next start or the start after that. He's too good of a pitcher not to come back. Will Smith, you're young. And
yeah, you don't know, kid. Yeah.
Yeah, you're very good. Yeah, no, he is not too good of a pitcher not to come back, because everybody eventually does not come back.
Yeah.
And it,
I think,
you know, yeah.
I think I'd do anything possible to get back to that is my favorite Tennyson poem.
I thought that was a Celine Dion song.
Yeah.
It is, because you think, you know, it's Syndergaard at the top of his game, pitching in New York, Thor, you know, finished third in the Cy Young voting in 2016 or whatever, you know, pitching, dueling with Madison Bumgarner in that wild card game, obviously pitching great in the 2015 playoffs as well. Like, he looked, there's like, and pitching too is so much more fragile generally than, you know, yeah, Will Smith is the catcher. Will Smith will eventually break down or move to first base or DH and have a season 34 where the bat speed goes and things like that. But with pitching, it is sort of, you know, brightest star burns out twice as fast kind of thing in a lot of cases. And yeah, I get it. Like, I'm sure that was an incredible high for him. You know, he worked for his entire life to be an ace starting pitcher, and very, very few players even get there for as briefly as Syndergaard does. And, you know, you can look at the Mets history on Tommy John recoveries if you really want to. It's not great. And, but again, you know, it's arm injuries can happen in any organization to any pitcher at any time.
There's only one certainty in this story, and that is that Jason Hayward Jr., in 15 years, I don't know if there is a Jason Hayward Jr., but he will be saying this about Will Smith when Will Smith, has a back problem and has to go on the IL and turns into a 60-day thing. It will happen again.
Like the old Bill James, decades superlative, old ball players never die. This is old ball players always die, I guess. Yep.
They always die.
We have a triumphant return to the mound this week, though, as Liam Hendricks has been declared cancer-free, completed his rehab in the minors, and rejoined the Chicago White Sox, and immediately got the experience of rejoining the 2023 Chicago White Sox in all its glory.
I don't feel like he deserves it, but, you know, I guess he doesn't really have any choice.
I suppose that there's a decent chance that that'll be taken care of by July 31st, so.
That is true. That is true.
But it is a great story. Great to see him back on the mound. One of the more fun relievers out there. I did love his quote in his first rehab game. He was very touched by the standing ovation he got, but he needs to be angry on the mound. And that was getting in the way of him being able to pitch, which is a very like Roy Kent kind of thing, I suppose. And we have another return. Not as triumphant, certainly, but Gary Sanchez is back with the Padres and hit a home run.
Yeah, he is. I find the Gary Sanchez thing very funny. It's interesting. Like, we talk about Syndergaard and how pitchers just disappear. And Sanchez really does feel like kind of the catcher equivalent, except there's no fanfare or sympathy or any kind of melancholy about it. He went from being good to just not, but instead of these quotes and instead of dreaming about his past glories, we're just like, oh yeah, Gary Sanchez is back in the major leagues again. This is the same story. Why are we acting so utterly differently to one and not the other?
I have a theory. I think it's because, you know how I mentioned that quote about the extreme profit compression from both sides or whatever on the RSNs? I kind of think that's like what it's being a catcher entering your 30s. Gary Sanchez is probably not 30.
I think he's exactly
might
30.
Be.
He's 30 and yeah. 181 days.
Yeah, it hits you fast, 30s.
It is. You look at, like, you know, Jonathan Lucroy was I don't think that comp for Will Smith. It was great. Was a huge deadline piece theoretically, and then 18 months was basically done as a regular.
And it was really funny because when he couldn't get a job out of spring training, and he ended up accepting a minor league deal, and it felt like it was a little surprising because the Giants clearly needed a catcher and they didn't get him, and now the Padres like legitimately did need Gary Sanchez, which is a real indictment on where the Padres are right now. But I like these kind of random June call-ups because we get April all over again. certain pieces of April. Currently, Gary Sanchez, his triple slash is 231, 214, 462.
That'll be under the slug. I'll be under the batting average. Well, that is very well early under. April. Yeah.
It's good that we still have a few of these left, like late season berries, just kind of like coming in, the flowers that grow in after everything else has died off. So you just got, oh yeah, we've still got a 231, 214 slash. That's a joy. Thank you, Gary Sanchez. Never walk again.
All right, Patrick, it's time to mosey on ourselves to topic number five. And is this the title of the game? Temporary pauses?
Yeah, temporary pauses.
Okay, we have a title this week.
We have a title this week. This may be a recurring thing. We'll see how you guys do. So also kind of mercifully simple compared to some of them. Well, the game is as follows. I'm going to give each of you, and we're just going to take turns. I'm going to give each of you a player's name, and I would like you to tell me whether they played shortstop.
Okay.
Whether they did it at the, you know, if you, for a bonus point, if you say no and you're correct, you get 2 points. If you say yes, you have to also guess whether they played it at the major league level or at the minor league level.
Okay.
All right. Now,
so at all, at any professional level,
at all, at any professional level, I did not count college.
Okay.
Because one of you is a lead prospect writer at Baseball Prospectus, I decided to even things out.
I don't watch college baseball.
Well, no, we're not. College doesn't count.
But you don't watch it more than I do.
But you do watch minor league baseball.
I do watch minor league baseball.
I made sure to pick players from the 90s mostly.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm sure you did that just on my behalf, Patrick.
Yeah, well, because also I had a box of baseball.
Talk about
90s
players. Yeah.
I had a box of baseball.
I know a lot of 90s players. So,
yeah. So, well, I mean, it's going to help you out a lot because actually maybe not knowing them might help. We'll see. All right. So, Jenny, we'll start with you, and I'm going to start with, we'll start with an easy one. We're going to start with, George Brett. Do you think George Brett played shortstop?
Yes, probably.
Do you think he played at the major league level?
I feel like at some point, probably.
All right. You're correct. 2 points. George Brett played 11 games at shortstop. At the major league level. Jeff, your turn. Also easy, Lou Whitaker.
Yes.
Okay. Major league minors.
If I recall correctly, he came up before Trammell, so I'm going to stay in the majors.
Okay. You are wrong. He only played six games of shortstop at the rookie league level. He only played second base his entire career. He never played any other position at the major league level.
I mean, that era was a little bit different too, especially in terms of like there was no showcase circuit, right? So we weren't really trying to keep guys at their primary position. They just played wherever their college coach wanted them to play, basically.
All right. So, Jimmy, your second one, Mickey Tettleton.
Never heard of him. He does sound shortstoppy.
His nickname was Fruit Loops. He was a catcher who once went on a hot streak where he attributed his power surge to eating Fruit Loops every morning.
Okay. I get it. Not with Fruit Loops, but I get it. No, I'm going to say no.
Okay. He did play one game.
Isn't he one of those guys that played every position in one game or something?
No.
I feel like that's going to be a trick question in here somewhere.
No, no. He played one game at AA, probably as an emergency. All right. Jeff, Steve Garvey.
Man, Steve Garvey, first baseman. I'm going to say yes in the minors.
Okay. You get 1 point. He actually played one game at shortstop at the major league level. Jenny, your next one, Adam Dunn.
I think he did at some point. I feel like I remember that.
The answer is no. He never played anything but outfield or first base.
He did play center field.
He did play center field. He did steal, he stole a fair amount of bases, but no. Jeff, Cecil Fielder.
Gonna say no.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Cecil Fielder did not play shortstop. I was hoping you'd agonize over that a little bit more.
I agonized a little because there's one player I know did play shortstop that was kind of built like Cecil Fielder, so I had to clearly join in.
Jenny, Jim Thome.
I'm gonna keep going, yes.
Major or minor?
Minor.
That is correct. He
Jim
played
Thome
40
was literally
games.
The player I was thinking of that kind of looked
Yep.
like Cecil Fielder and came up as a shortstop. Yeah.
He played 40 games at short.
He was, I mean, he didn't look like Cecil Fielder then, I guess, but
no. But he was, you know, and then he played, he reached the majors as a third baseman. Next, Jeff, Matt Stairs.
Stairs. I feel maybe misremembering this because it was the 90s, but I feel like Matt Stairs was a catching convert from like third base. So I'm going to say yes, minors.
Okay, you are correct. Yeah. He actually played second, short, and third.
Yeah,
he was an
infield. I
was
thought he was an
shortstop
infield
in high
convert.
A.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, Jenny, yours is Jack Clark.
I don't think I know who this is. No.
You are correct. Jack Clark came up as a third baseman, but never played short. Jeff Bagwell.
University of Hartford kid. I'm gonna say no. I think he only played third.
Correct.
Yeah.
All right. It is currently 8-6. Jenny, you need to get this one. This is the last one, so you need to nail this and have him be wrong. Yours mm-hmm. is Kevin Mitchell.
Well, I think I need the extra points, so I'm going to say yes.
Okay, you are correct. He played 28 games at short at the major league level.
That was the Davey Johnson started him at
yep.
short and Howard Johnson at third when Sid Fernandez was on the mound. Yes.
And lastly, for the win, Jeff,
mm-hmm.
Mickey Mantle.
Mickey Mantle. Huh. I'll tell you, I don't have a strong memory of Mickey Mantle's minor league career. I feel like there's fewer of these infield outfield converts until more recently. But I'm going to say yes, minors.
You get a point because he actually played 7 games
Wow.
at shortstop at the major league level. Interestingly enough, Mantle played short. Like those 7 games are spread across 3 different seasons. He played 1 game in 53, 4 in 54, and 2.
I would weirdly
55.
feel like you got more weird tactical shit with like pinch hitting and pinch running in that era. So you might have had to do some unusual defensive alignments from time to
Mantle
time.
played actually every single position, at one, except for pitcher and catcher in his career, and DH, which didn't exist when he was around. So, all right, that is it, Jeff. You win 9-8. Congratulations. I hope you both win in the sense that it was a fairly low pain experience.
It was actually, although it won't feel like it to our listener, a shorter game. Than
yeah, it was
one
short.
We had to like do writing for 10 minutes. Yeah. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Five and Dive, brought to you by the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. You can get in touch with the show at fiveanddive@baseballprospectus.com or by finding the nearest person named Craig and sending a message to the network of Craigs. If you subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other podcast sources, enjoy what we're doing here. We'd appreciate it if you rate and review us. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you once again next week.